things that I learned since that moment, which was also one of the hardest things for myself, is you don't quite realize the effect that you ending your own life is going to have on the people around you. So one of the things that sticks with me today and absolutely breaks my heart is that my parents got that dreaded knock on the door that no parent ever wants to get. And it was that moment of opening the door and there's a police officer standing in front of them. And that's something that now I want no parent to ever have to face with their young child, because yeah, I can't imagine how that feels, and I never want to imagine how that feels.
That's Brad Wright, and he very nearly wasn't here to tell this story. Brad's teenage years were a mess, with the combination of depression, crippling low self-esteem, and refusing help almost costing him his life. He had to learn how to walk again, and even that paled in comparison to working out how to love himself for the first time. Now, 6 years on from what could have been the end, Brad's helping teenagers and young adults to realise their value.
Welcome to Young Blood, the award-winning volunteer podcast dedicated to young men's mental health. My name's Callum McPherson. I'm a journalist, and this is a platform for everyday men to share lived experience stories and show that no matter what you're going through, you're not alone. Suicide is the number one killer of young people, and changing that starts with speaking up. So let's do it.
If you haven't already, please subscribe to this podcast so you don't miss a thing. Help us reach more people by taking 10 seconds to give the show a rating on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. And if you've got some feedback on this conversation, I'd love to hear it. You can vote in the poll and leave a comment on every Spotify episode. I read them all.
Trigger warning, if you find anything spoken about in today's episode distressing, please contact Lifeline on 13 11 14. Brad, where did you grow up?
I grew up in Armidale, New South Wales, and I moved to the Gold Coast when I was 10 years old.
And what was it like growing up on the Goldie?
So if I was to compare growing up on the Gold Coast to growing up where I came from, I would say it's a lot more fast-paced. And while there is a lot more opportunity, you can slide through the crevices a lot more in terms of the school system.
So it's sort of the case that a lot of people move through the Gold Coast, but they don't necessarily, you don't meet that many people who come from the Gold Coast or grew up there. Is that sort of what it's like?
I find I meet a lot of people that moved here from, say, Melbourne and places down south, so colder climate places, even like New Zealand. I find a lot of people moving here from New Zealand just because of the weather change and the lifestyle change. So yeah, I definitely meet a lot of people on the Gold Coast that weren't born here. They moved here at some point in their life.
So do you have a strong connection to it?
Yeah, I love it. And I believe that all the opportunity I've had comes obviously from me myself, but also where I live. So a lot of the opportunities have arisen from the place I live and the people I surround myself with in this place.
But that didn't used to be the case. Tell us about how it was for you being a teenager.
Very different times. So as a teenager for myself, so I was in school, I was going through, when we first moved up here, my parents put me into private school. And then I just, because obviously when I was in my hometown, I was in public schools. And then them transitioning me into private schools from that, I didn't gel with that system. And that could also come from how you've been raised. I didn't gel with that private school system. So I got put back into the public school system, where I then fell into hanging around the wrong people, smoking weed, getting into cars at a young age. That's just like from my parents, like we own a mechanic shop and stuff. So when I was, from the time I was able to walk, I was in around cars and stuff. And then I started getting into cars and like growing up, being into drugs and hanging around cars, doing the wrong thing, getting in trouble, spending all your money on either cars or drugs. Yeah. So I got led down that path, and that led me into where I was when I had my attempt at suicide.
So what first got you on that path when you were such a young kid and you ended up with the wrong crowd? Because it's a real interesting age as we go into teenagehood, and pretty difficult for parents to try to navigate, and it seems like we've all experienced going our own road, but you can sort of go one way or the other, and it comes down a lot to where you are and who you meet at that time. We're very impressionable. So yeah. on reflection, how did you end up going that way?
Yeah, so I think there's a lot of things that contributed to where I went in life. Like, obviously, as kids, we're all like a sponge. So from the age of 0 to 7, you are like a sponge to everyone and everything around you. And I think I had, between that age, I had a very, like, in a country town sort of upbringing where the old man would go to the pub every Friday night and stuff. And that was sort of the culture that I was around there. They were all into cars. And I think that sort of, when I was in that impressionable stage in my life, that was what I saw and that was what I believed life was. So then coming into being a teenager, I started to rebel a lot. And I think that a lot of children do it, and there's a lot of behavioral patterns that get instilled in you as a kid that people don't even realize unless they're actually consciously aware that of behavioral patterns. So I think it was just because of all the people that were around me in my life from 0 to say 17 years old, they were impressioning me as a kid without even knowing it. And this is something I've learned since diving into a lot of this deeper work, is that people aren't even aware that their behavior has such an effect on young kids. Like, for example, people always say, like, couples could have arguments in front of their toddler and they're like, oh, it doesn't matter, he's just a toddler, he doesn't even understand what we're talking about. But what they don't actually realize is quite how much of an effect that is having on that toddler. And
well, I think no matter how young we are, we pick up on the tone and the energy and the tension of the situation, and kids that pick up on a whole lot of things, even if they might not understand all of it, and they certainly won't if they're really, really young, but we still pick up heaps from our environment and the way people talk to us and treat us in that time. So do you think that you had it drilled into you from a young age that men went to the pub and talked about cars, and then you were trying to create that in your own life as you started to turn into an adult? Like, you were prioritizing those things because that's what you thought a man was supposed to do?
I definitely, like, unconsciously had these beliefs, and I wasn't even aware of them. I just grew up and assumed that this is what a man does and who a man is. And I would say I just grew up thinking that as a man, you went to the pub, like, you got blind drunk, you had a chat with your friends, and like, you worked 5 days a week hating your job, and then it's like Friday night, it's like, yep, sweet, go out, get drunk. And that's unconsciously what I was getting, I guess, programmed. And in saying that, it's no one's fault that these programs have been instilled in you as a kid, because 99% of the time, people aren't even aware that you can program a kid so much. People just think, oh, like, as a teenager, these behavioral patterns, oh, that's just the age they are. Like, that's just what they do. And yeah, when you're unaware of all these unconscious patterns, it's like, that's the belief that you can have. But yeah,
and as your influences aren't doing it on purpose. Of course, people generally, well, either they don't care that much about you, or they want the best for you, hopefully. And they're certainly not thinking, oh, me being a grown man and talking this way and behaving this way around a kid is going to contribute to shaping them into who they're going to be. I mean, you might think, oh yeah, I guess if you hung around enough, like, they could pick up something, but you wouldn't necessarily imagine, oh, this is going to heavily influence the way that this kid thinks going forward. So what about your parents? Because do you come from a healthy home? Were they strict on you or not?
This is actually something I've reflected a lot on since becoming a parent myself. I would say, like, I have beautiful parents that love and support me through absolutely everything. And, like, through my life, I don't, like, they're not into the kind of work that I'm into in terms of all these unconscious patterns and why things show up. So I think without even realizing it, certain things that they were doing were programming me unconsciously without them even realizing. And yeah, in saying that, like, I can't fault my parents on anything. And I don't think that anything's their fault, because they've loved and supported me through every single stage of my life, whether I was, you know, I was like 18, going out drinking and partying and smoking weed. They still loved me through that. And so, yeah, I can't fault them in terms of that, but I definitely think, being that we were from a country town where you grow up to believe like that it's normal in a marriage to fight and stuff like that, unconsciously I was hearing that. And yeah, there were so many patterns that were instilled in me that later in life, when I started diving into a bit of my unconscious and what was there, I started to bring up a lot of that.
And you had that love and support through your whole life, which you're lucky to have, and there's lots of people who don't, but you still suffered so much with your mental health. Just tell us a bit about your experience of how you perceived yourself and what you had to deal with when you were between, 13, 17.
I think my journey with my mental health sort of started around the age of 12. I'm not going to generalize it and say everyone does, because there are some men out there that are young that are trying to get help. And I will say a lot of young men have a bit of an ego around their mental health, like, I don't need help. And they believe that they've got it under control. And for me, this is where I was. So as a young man, being 12 years old, and that was when I first got admitted to hospital for attempting to commit suicide. Now that I look back at it, I don't think that attempt at suicide was actually trying to kill myself. I think that was a bit of an attention-seeking thing. So I got sent to hospital. I refused help from day one. So I got put in with like a counselor, and I just refused to speak. I just sat there in my chair silently, and it completely ignored everything. I just shut it out, had a blank face. And yeah, definitely for myself, that was where it started. So then going into your teenage years from that, every now and then things had come up for me, and mental health would rear its ugly head. And like, my parents, all they knew was like psychologists for mental health. And I will say a lot of people in even today's day and age don't know any other way around it. Like, for themselves and their kids, they, as soon as they hear mental health, they think either go to a doctor and get a prescription or go to a counselor, and that's the only way. And definitely for me growing up, that was what it was, because everyone just, yeah, people don't know what's actually out there for them. And I got put into, I couldn't even count how many counselors' offices I went to as a young man. And every single time I'd go there, I'd just shut off and I wouldn't speak. And then I'd leave, I'd walk out and just like, I don't need to sit in a room and listen to some 40-year-old man try and tell me how to live my life as a young, like, let's say 13, 14-year-old. I was like, I don't need a 40-year-old man telling me how to help myself. So, yeah, so it was just,
Brad,
about shutting out.
I know you're a man of reflection, and you've done a lot of that over the past 6 years. What was at the core of that belief of refusing help, and so aggressively so? If you strip it all back and simplify it, what was the thought process that stopped you allowing any of that to come in?
I'm glad you asked that question, because I was actually reflecting on this today, and I think it was definitely my ego telling me that if I accepted help, I wasn't seen as a strong man. I was seen as a weak person. So I definitely think at the core of that whole belief system of shutting out from help, there was that belief that I'd be seen as weaker if I did. And I think a lot of people struggle with this without even realizing it.
What did you think was going to happen if you kept refusing and refusing and refusing and just keeping it to yourself? Like, did you see a positive outcome as having potential, or you didn't think that far?
To be completely honest, as a young man, I didn't think of the outcome. I was just thinking about now, and I was like, no, if I shut it out and I deal with it myself, it'll be fine. There's a metaphor that I like to use now. It's like you're walking through life with a bag, and every time something happens, you can stuff it in the bag, or you can actually unwrap this bit of paper and figure out what's on there. And going through my life, when these events had come up where I would get depressed, cry out for help, I would put these bits of paper in my bag, and it just got to a point where your bag overflows and it's going to explode. So yeah, I definitely look back and see that now.
But at the time you were feeling that weight and you were just filling up your bag and obviously carrying that around with you. But was it your mindset that, oh, that's just what it is to be a man, and it doesn't matter how heavy it gets, you just keep carrying it and don't complain?
Yeah, definitely. 100%. And that was because growing up, like, that's what I would hear among even dad's mates and stuff, like, oh, you're a man, you just deal with it and you keep going. You just, like, we don't get to talk about our feelings. We're not like women. And then that was this belief that I unconsciously took on.
Yeah.
And it's still something I hear today so often in the world. I've just stepped back into an industry where it is predominantly males, and it's a trade industry where, like, men come up to me within a week of being there. And it's interesting now because I'm, I guess, such a safe space for people to talk to. Unconsciously, people come up and talk to me without, like, I don't have any rapport built with them, but they'll just come and open up to me.
Yep.
And this guy actually came up to me and opened up, and he had a lot of stuff going on in his life. But at the end of this conversation, he goes, you're a fucking man. He's like, you don't deal with this stuff. We keep going and we just provide. And it's, yeah, so interesting that this belief is carried out through society so commonly still today.
Yeah.
And I guess that's a stigma that we want to break down.
Yeah, well, that's a great example of it. And I think a lot of men get caught up in a way that it's totally unhelpful, because on the one hand, the goal is, I want to be the protector, the provider, the man who can handle it all and just keep going. But fundamentally misunderstanding that the best way to do that is to be able to have the self-awareness to admit when you needed to deal with something and not just bury it. And that if you're able to actually work on that skill and be brave enough to face those things, you're actually going to be way more equipped to handle life. So I think we need to grow to be able to see it that way, rather than, oh, I'll handle it and I'll be the manliest man I can be by just continuing to fill up the bag till it overflows and just hoping for the best, which we know doesn't work.
Yeah. And that's exactly right. And one thing that was coming up a lot recently was, it was really interesting because my dad still obviously has a lot of really good mates back in our hometown, and the amount of men around his age, so he's in his 50s, the amount of men that are around his age that are killing themselves there, so it's a very small town, there's not a lot there in terms of help when you're struggling with your mental health. And it's, as I said, that culture of just suppress it and you just keep going. And the amount of men that he's been coming to me saying, oh, this bloke's killed himself, this bloke's killed himself. And he actually came up to me, I think it was about 6 months ago, and said, oh, my best mate had to cut his dad off a rope. And he said all his life, his dad was one of those blokes that was like that real country guy who was like, you just keep going, you get life done. And at the end of the day, he was the one getting cut down off the rope. And that's saddening to hear that, because sometimes the blokes that seem so put together on the surface have the most shit bubbling just down there below the surface.
Well, you said it. That bag does fill up, and it doesn't matter how badly you want to wish it away, it's not going to go away. And as a human being, you can only handle so much emotional baggage and so much pressure before it breaks you. And that's just a fact of life. And I think it's about trying to shift that culture so that men realize that the best thing that they can do to continue to be able to handle life and push through it, which is the stereotypical masculine, manly thing that we want. We're not saying don't do that. Like, yeah, do that. Absolutely. It's great to want to be that kind of man that can have the world on their shoulders and be the hero for their family. Nothing wrong with that at all. But just understanding that the best way for you to do that is to be able to bring other people into the picture and actually face up to stuff while it's happening, as scary as that is, and deal with that at the time so that it doesn't end in disaster years down the line that totally destroys your family and the community. When you were a kid, why did you have such low self-esteem?
I would definitely say in my high schooling years, there was a massive culture between men at school that you were always putting someone else down to make yourself feel better. And it's something I'm still seeing come up today. So I would say as a kid, I definitely didn't get bullied. Like, I wasn't someone who always getting picked on all the time, but I would definitely say even within my, probably not within my close friends. So I probably would say that's like when you're in school, say 4 or 5 people max, but within the friend circle that we were in, which could have been up to 20 people, there was a lot of that culture of putting each other down. And whenever something small would come up, taking that and running with it and just destroying that person. And then it's sort of like that culture, like, oh, I feel really good now because like he's seen as below me. And it's that hierarchy that you're trying to create when you're in school. And this is something that's like, it comes up so often for me now working with these young men, because one thing I've seen in the last program I did is that this hierarchy was so great that these young men struggled to connect with each other if they weren't mates. And they were like, if they didn't like someone, they're like, oh no, like I'm not working with him in this exercise. Like I don't want to and stuff. And yeah, I guess it's a lot of that hierarchy in school, which put my self-esteem so low. And yeah, what contributed so much to my mental health decline.
And you didn't feel like you had the power to turn that around and work on yourself even as a young teenager to make yourself feel better? Did you just sort of automatically go to feeling powerless and like you hadn't been given whatever it is that you needed to be the most popular kid or be the kind of person that you wanted to be, and therefore you were hopeless in that sort of a teenage way that, well, we just haven't been around very long yet and perhaps don't have the best perspective on our lives and what we do have. And so you can very easily get caught up thinking about what you don't have and what you don't lack and your insecurities.
Yeah. So I would definitely say in terms of that, my belief system back then was like, I'll figure it out myself. And then that led to me suppressing these emotions that were coming up every time I'd feel like depression or something coming on. It was like, oh, smoke weed or go out drinking on the weekend and just get absolutely slaughtered. And it was always about suppressing these emotions. So for myself, as a young man in school, I would just suppress everything I felt instead of dealing with it. And yeah, I'd say that contributed a lot, because I don't think back then I thought I had the tools. I always told myself, no, I'll deal with it. But my way of dealing with it was just to suppress it. It wasn't to work on these feelings. It was just like, nah, get rid of them. As soon as I don't feel them directly, they're not there.
Yeah. Well, nothing new there. That's the age-old story. But of course, yeah. I think when we're younger, we think it's possible to actually get rid of that. And that if we can get ourselves to a state where we don't feel it momentarily because we're intoxicated or we're distracted or whatever it might be, we actually think, oh, cool, that's gone now. But of course, it's never actually gone unless you work on it and deal with it and accept it. And that's a very hard thing to do if you think accepting it means that you're not the man you're supposed to be, and that's a fate worse than death would be to accept that you're actually your version of weak, which none of this is true, but it's a difficult thing to educate yourself on, and especially years and years ago before there was so much talk around these sorts of things.
On that sort of topic, like around how men see it's weak to dive into all this work around your mental health, they're like, nah, I just need to be seen as a man, and I need to be seen as strong and someone who can support the people around me. One thing I've learned since actually doing this sort of work and bringing up all these driving factors that were helping my mental health decline is that people around you actually see you as so much stronger for being able to consciously aware of your mental health, and it's seen as so much stronger to be able to deal with it than what it's seen as to not deal with it. And this is a very hard truth for a lot of men to accept, and I guess that's where the mission of bringing this worldwide so that men can start to realize that you don't have to sit there and sob and cry every night and say like everything that happened in the day, but when you can be in an environment where you can bring these things up, you can sit in it for like a day or something when you're at this event and you work on these things, and then you come out of it feeling like 10 times stronger. You know, you've dealt with these driving factors instead of just suppressing it. Like, man, you're going to go 1,000 times further in life when you can deal with these and when you can suppress them.
Yeah. And you bring up an important point saying it's not about sitting there and crying necessarily. Not that there's anything wrong with that, but I think guys get the view of, oh, so I have to talk about my feelings all the time, and every day has to be a therapy session, and we have to hold hands and sing Kumbaya constantly. And I get that that puts men off, especially men who come from those hyper-masculine sorts of environments that you've described. And that's not what we're saying. Another guy from the Gold Coast who was on the podcast recently, Tyron, he was talking about the concept of vulnerability and how he prefers to just call it honesty, which I quite liked, because I think vulnerability is a big buzzword these days. And of course, we do want men to be more vulnerable, but I think that can put us off hearing that all the time. And so he interchanged it with just the word honest. Like, can you be honest with yourself, and can you be honest with other people? So, you know, when you're feeling really bad and like something's not right, can you be honest with yourself and say, I feel shit, like I know I have to do something about this? Or someone who loves you asks you, you know, hey, what's going on? Are you okay? Can you be honest with them in that moment? I mean, that's the same as what we're saying in terms of vulnerability, but it's really just, are you brave enough to be honest when it counts? And that's sort of the message.
I love that, because there's so many men out there that they can't even admit to themselves that they need help. And that's not even reaching out for the help. A lot of men actually struggle to admit to themselves that they're struggling with their mental health. And this can be one of the hardest challenges to overcome. It's not even reaching out to someone else. It's actually about admitting to yourself, oh, wow, I really need some help here. Because as men, so commonly, like I guess this is speaking to the men that are in their hyper-masculine, they're always on mission, on purpose, providing for their family, themselves, and trying to create whatever their definition of financial freedom is. So, yeah, these are the men that so often don't admit it to themselves. And that can be something that is overlooked so much. So often we say, oh, it's all about reaching out. And yes, it is about reaching out, but can you admit to yourself that you need help?
And even before needing help, can you admit to yourself that what you're doing or the way you're thinking or the coping mechanisms that you're using aren't working? So it might not even be, oh, okay, you need to go and go to someone for help yet, but maybe it's, okay, can you be honest with yourself about you're just drinking too much piss, or you're gambling too much, or you're not speaking to your partner the way you should be speaking to your partner? Can you wise up to yourself when that stuff's happening before you need to go and bring someone in to help you? But can you say, okay, this is bullshit, I need to cut this out, and actually manage to do that? I mean, these are difficult things, and that's a skill, that's a muscle that you need to work, that self-awareness. And And those things are very easy to push away, especially when the narrative we've been told is that, oh yeah, men can do those things and men do just push it away. So that's what you should do. But we've got to get beyond that. So what led up to your serious suicide attempt when you were 17?
Leading up to that, so I think from the age of 12, when I had my first attempt at suicide, which was a bit of a cry for help, I suppressed everything. And then at the age of 16, I got into a relationship, and it was like my first serious committed relationship with someone that was long-term. And throughout this relationship, now that I can look back, there were so many things that were warning signs to what was to come. So like, I used to always use language like, oh, I think if we ever broke up, like I'd just kill myself and stuff. And I'd say it so casually. And even around this time, like whenever my mum would bring up something and she's like, oh, what if this happens? I was just like, oh, I'd just kill myself. And she's like, don't joke about that. And I'm like, oh, it's just a joke. Like, don't worry, stop stressing. And
but the way you talk becomes casually real. The way you talk manifests in your behavior. And that's a little sign, like things for parents and friends to look out for. If people say throwaway comments like that, even if it's like, it seems like, oh, it's tongue in cheek and they're joking, that's a common tactic that people will use to sort of gauge the response to it. And you can guess if people are saying that, especially if they're saying that sort of thing regularly, that that's actually a genuine thought that they're having. So it's an important thing to look out for. And in the context of a relationship, telling your partner, oh, if you left me, I'd kill myself, is of course emotional manipulation tactic as well, which you're probably not aware of when you're that young that that's what you're doing, but that is what that is.
It's, yeah, definitely something. And like, I look back at that relationship and like the back and forth between us both, it was a typical, at that age, when you're unaware of all that, it was that typical young relationship where you're in love, but you have so much emotional baggage that you don't know of that you're carrying that into the relationship. So I definitely, going into that relationship, like I wasn't aware of half the things I was saying in there, like throwing out comments like that. Like now that I look back at that, it's so clear to me. And I guess in the time, like I didn't even see it.
And that relationship ended. Did that contribute to it?
Yes. Yeah, definitely. So that relationship ended. And then this is around the time when the suicide attempt happened. So that was a massive contributor. So it was sort of like when this relationship ended, all these emotions that I'd been suppressing with this relationship and things I'd been suppressing with weed and alcohol, they'd all hit me at once. So it was like someone just got this bag that I've been throwing little pebbles in my whole life and they just tipped it on my head. And yeah, it was like everything hit me like a 10-ton brick. And I had no idea how to deal with these emotions because all my life, all I knew is how to suppress things.
What was your thought process at that time?
I have a bit of a blank period. So I remember from the Sunday we went down to a unit we had in Coffs Harbour together. And I remember putting petrol in my car Sunday. And then it was just like this period of black between Sunday and Tuesday. Now looking back, like from the time it happened to almost 7 years later, I remember snippets of the actual night that the suicide attempt happened. And there was a lot of emotion, but I didn't know I was going to kill myself. I just felt numb to everything in the world, but so emotional at the same time.
Okay, but you didn't actually have specific intent that was going to be the time and that was going to be the method. It was like there was just a rush of feeling and numbness at the same time.
Yeah, definitely. And it was so overwhelming that I didn't like, and it sounds weird to say this, all my life before this, I had this thing where I could see like parts of my future where I was like, oh, like I can see this picture here. Like it's very vivid, but like I can see here. And then it was like, I always said to myself, like, at some point around my late teen years, everything just goes numb. And it's like, I don't see anything past that. And then, yeah, this specific night, I wouldn't say that I went into it like, I'm going to kill myself tonight. That's it. It was just like so emotionally triggered that all the events leading up to it were preparing myself for a suicide attempt without even realizing. So, like, at the time, I had utensils to be able to smoke weed stashed in my car, like under my spare wheel. So I went and, like, I hid everything in my car. I took it all out and hid it in the bush. And then I called a couple people and these people didn't answer. So I went to a lookout, and I always went to this lookout. So I'm just sitting there looking over the Gold Coast. I think this was the moment where everything switched, and I didn't even know how I was going to do it, but I knew I was going to kill myself. And I'd said this many times before, like, messaged my friends and said, oh, I want to kill myself. And then I'd done nothing. So in this instance, what I did is I messaged two of my friends and at the time my ex-partner and said, this is what I'm going to do. Like, I love you all. And then that was it. I sent the message and turned off my phone, threw the phone onto, like, passenger floor. And I think I didn't have in my head how I was going to do it. And I don't even know if I had convinced myself I was going to do it yet. But at this moment, I guess I'd sent the message and that was it. Something was different this time, though.
And so it sounds like you had all this build up, and on reflection, it's pretty obvious that that was a storm that was brewing and it was going to reach that conclusion. But it is interesting that you say that until that 5 minutes where you were sitting there at the lookout, going through all these thoughts in your head that would have triggered you to the point where you started to decide that you were going to take this sort of action, that you didn't actually have that obvious intent. Because I think when we usually talk about suicide and suicide attempts, and we even ask in practice, when someone is having those thoughts, the next question is, do you have a plan? You know, have you thought it out yet? And the answer to that is often yes. So to say that, you know, only moments before you actually made that attempt, you hadn't even decided you were going to make that attempt, I think that's interesting.
Yeah, and it's actually very interesting, because I think I only made the decision in a split second. So what I did after this is I sent the message, and then, so this lookout, it was on a bit of a hill. It was on a bit of a windy hill, like, it wasn't too far up, but I've started driving down this hill, pretty windy, and I don't remember the drive, but the people that saw me do my, like, attempt said I was come around this corner, and they said, like, just judging that I was doing about 150 Ks an hour. So, like, I think unconsciously I was driving like I didn't care. I was just pretty much foot down and I didn't care what happened. So then I remember coming around this corner, and this was like the one moment that stuck with me ever since. And it's something that I can explain it to people 1,000 times, but I can never give them my perspective from that day. So I've come around this corner and I remember this so clearly. It was as the sun was going down, and as I've come around the corner, I've seen trees in front of me. And it was sort of like my whole world stopped in this moment. No matter how fast my car was going, it felt like this moment went for 10 years. Everything stopped. And I was like, okay, I saw in front of me a set of trees, and in the hole, middle was a black hole. And I looked at it and I was like, wow, I was like, are you ready to die? And then I thought about it for a moment and I was like, yeah. And it was just that acceptance that I was ready to die and I didn't want to be here anymore. Yeah, then that was the moment that I just let go of everything. And it was like, I don't even remember hitting the gutter, because my body had switched off before that. So yeah, it's really interesting, because so often people think that it's this massive climax before it happens, but it was like in this moment, everything just stopped. And I wouldn't even say there was any emotion left. It was just like numb, and it was like, I love this quote from Robin Williams that I seen recently, and it was like, when your body's sick of playing this character and it just doesn't want to be this character you're playing anymore, it wants to be itself. And I think at that moment I just got over playing this character that I wasn't to impress other people, and everything flicked, and I just drove straight off a 20-meter embankment, and yeah, that was it.
But of course, what you've come to learn, thankfully, because you survived, is that you could stop playing that character without killing yourself.
Yeah, and I think this is something that everyone can stop playing this character if they want, because I think in the society we live in today, social media, I guess, has contributed so much to creating this image for everyone else to see and not letting people see who you truly are. And I think for myself as a young kid, yeah, I was putting on that front because I wanted to be seen as someone else by everyone around me, when who I truly was wasn't getting the attention that he needed.
But you could have been that authentic version of yourself at that age, and I'm sure it would have been well received and you would have been loved. But the point is that we wear these masks and we're so convinced, especially when we're teenagers and the emotions run so high and we're not fully developed yet, and we just fully believe in this story that we tell ourselves. And the scary part is, whatever you tell yourself, it's the gift and the curse. It can manifest and become true. And that can be an amazing story, and it can be a horrific story as well. And the power of the mind can make that manifest in reality. And you're an example of that. How close did you come to dying?
Yeah, so driving off this cliff down a 20-meter embankment, there was about three or four things that are the reason I'm here today. So going off this embankment, as I said before, there was two people walking at the exact time that I did this. So they saw me do it, and they've managed to get down to the car and saw how bad it was, saw like what state I was in, and a surgeon actually lived in the street. So they've gone back up, got the surgeon to come down, and he stabilized me in the car until the ambulance got there, because I was unconscious and I was bleeding out through my knee. So he stabilized me until the ambulance got there, and then one of the fast response ambulances came, which is like the SUVs, and the fast response ambulance that responded was one of the only ones on the Gold Coast that night that could give blood transfusions on the side of the road. So I had about three or four blood transfusions before they got me out of the car. And another thing was that in my car, I had, so as like a young bloke who loved cars, I had a genuine, it's called a Recaro racing seat. And this specific seat wasn't legal to have in a car, like a road use car, because it was for track cars. And the police actually said to my parents when I was in a coma, like, they came into the hospital and said, look, like, we've got a list of defects on that car, but because one of those defects are one of the reasons why he's still here today, we actually can't give him fines for it.
So that seat actually helped secure you.
When I've hit the ground, like, I didn't get sort of ragdolled in the car, like, it actually hugged me tight. So, yeah, there was multiple things that happened exactly how they needed to that night. So I've learned since, so like, I'm not someone who goes to church every Sunday and swears by the Bible, but I definitely believe that there was someone looking out for me that night. And you can use whatever word you want for whoever you think that could have been, but for me, I definitely believe that there was a God looking out for me that night, and he sent the angels that needed to look after me to be there with me. So everything happened in divine timing, because I had a higher purpose in this world.
Do you remember anything about being in a coma?
No. So I was in an induced coma for 2 weeks, and I don't remember being in the coma. I remember the moment of waking up in the hospital. having no idea what happened. So waking up, and apparently I did this for about a week. I'd wake up in the morning and just be like, "Hey guys, what's going on?" And I'd look around and they're like, "Oh yeah, we're in hospital. How are you?" And then I'd just have a chat with them, oblivious to sort of everything that was happening. And then my first question was always, "Oh, like they said I had a car accident." And I'm like, "Oh, is my car okay?" And they're like, "Oh no, your car's probably going to be a write-off." And I was like, "Oh," because I was an apprentice panel beater at the time. I was like, "No, I can fix it." They were like, "No, no, no." And then that's sort of what led into starting to, I guess, find out what truly happened, because I had at this moment no recollection. I had, last thing I remember, life was normal. I went to sleep and I woke up in a hospital and had no recollection of anything in between. And I definitely, one of the things that I learned since that moment, which was also one of the hardest things for myself, is you don't quite realize the effect that you ending your own life is going to have on the people around you. So one of the things that sticks with me today and absolutely breaks my heart is that my parents got that dreaded knock on the door that no parent ever wants to get. And it was that moment of opening the door, and there's a police officer standing in front of them. And that's something that now I want no parent to ever have to face with their young child, because, yeah, I can't imagine how that feels, and I never want to imagine how that feels.
How does your mom talk about that now?
She's very emotionally triggered by this whole event still to this day. She can't like hear certain things and see certain photos from this event because it triggers her so much. And looking back now as a parent myself, to even begin to think of how that feels is one of the most unexplainable feelings. And yeah, I never ever want another parent of a teenager to have to experience that, let alone anyone else in this world have to experience, as I said before, cutting their dad off a rope.
Something that 17-year-old Brad couldn't possibly understand.
Yeah. And so commonly, even I guess for people like in their middle age period where they think of attempting suicide or attempt suicide, no one understands quite how it affects the people around you. And for myself, like I just thought no one would even care if I died tomorrow. And that was my thought process before I did it. And then to wake up after committing so much to that attempt, like I've not met many people in my life since that have gone that far with an attempt of suicide and survived. So to wake up from, going that far and dealing with the repercussions of doing that is, probably one of the worst feelings I've ever had in my life. And watching how it affected everyone around me was, it was absolutely fucking heartbreaking. Like I had a cousin that was halfway around the world that was half in reception, half out, and he got a call saying, I don't even think he got a call directly saying who had done it. He just got a call saying one of your cousins is in hospital about to die, and he's halfway around the world. And it's like these are the things you can't realize how it's going to affect everyone else, not just you.
Yeah, and you're fortunate enough to survive and see the reality of how much love there is for you. And that's one of the great tragedies of suicide is people can't see that and feel that till it's too late. And of course, people aren't attempting suicide believing that it's going to hurt someone else, or like you said, you get so warped that you think, oh, this is just going to be better for everyone and no one's going to miss me and I'm a burden. And no matter who you are, that couldn't be further from the truth. But it's also not a selfish act, because when you're in a spiral like you describe being in, there's so much pain and so much emotion and so much confusion, and you're in such a confused mind state that you can't possibly think straight. And so you're not thinking about other people at that time either. You're thinking about yourself and the pain that you're in and wanting that to end. So it's not about passing any blame on anyone either. So what was the damage?
I broke both my legs and I've now got 30 screws and 3 plates, fractured my pelvis, had nerve damage in my left shoulder, so I had no control over my left arm anymore. Broke my jaw in 3 places. I had $100,000 of dental work and I had 3 brain bleeds. So coming out of that as a 17-year-old kid, being in a wheelchair, being in hospital, and because I'd been on a drip feed in a coma for 2 weeks, I had no more weight left on my body. So I was pretty much just skin and bone. Coming out of that as a 17-year-old kid, I look back and that was one of the hardest things I've ever done in my life. And to do that as a 17-year-old, yeah, it's indescribable watching all your friends go out and get their license and going on road trips and doing all this fun stuff like graduating high school and going to schoolies or whatever it is. And like you're sitting there, not able to walk, you're reliant on your parents to get up and go to the toilet. Or I guess at the start it was in hospital. I was sitting in a hospital bed. The police had took my phone to go through it. So I had like nothing. I was just sitting there thinking about everything that had happened for 3 months before I'd even got out of hospital. And then, yeah, getting out, it's like you feel like a 90-year-old person in a nursing home because you're reliant on everyone else to even have a shower or go get up and go to the toilet to go pee or something like that.
Yeah. And you know that you did it to yourself as well. Mm. So there's dealing with those difficult emotions of guilt and shame wrapped into that.
Yeah.
How did you feel about 100%. Still being alive, given that you were in that situation because of a suicide attempt? When you were conscious again and you started to come back to Earth, did you want to be alive all of a sudden, or was that gradual?
Coming out of that, I think I dove even more into depression. So being like 17 years old, as I said, in a wheelchair, you're not able to walk, you look different to everyone around you. All these stories started to play out in my head and I just began to hate myself even more and more from this experience. And then I just went into life like, I would say for the next 2 years, my attitude towards life, and I said this very openly, I was like, I was supposed to die that night, so I don't care about being alive.
So what changed? Did you allow yourself to receive help at some point? I'm thinking you must have.
Yeah, so we'll go into a little bit of what happened. So I, coming out of this, as I said, like spiraled into that even deeper depression, carried on like using weed and alcohol to suppress things, and then started, as I guess between the ages of like 18 and 19, I started going out to like nightclubs and getting on pills and stuff. And then it got to a point where I guess towards the end of all that period of my life, I started to realize I'm like, this just, it's like, it's not what I want to do anymore. And it's like, even though I didn't know about any of this kind of work that I'm doing now, I just knew that this life wasn't for me anymore. And then it's a funny story about how I came to start helping myself, because I was on a night out on New Year's and I was at a nightclub and I was selling pills and I had my two mates like getting me people, and this guy came, like my mate gave me this guy and he's like, hey dude, like I want to buy some stuff off you. And I sold it to him, and then I actually just started talking to him because he looked like a real fit guy and someone, I guess, who I wanted to look like, because I hated my body image so much. So started talking to this guy, and I'd recently signed up at World Gym, but I didn't really commit to it because I knew no one there and it was pretty scary walking into this massive gym with all these massive guys when I was this age and I was skin and bone. So I met this guy and started talking to him. He goes, oh, I train at World Gym too. And I was like, wow, dude, like we should train together sometime. And it was New Year's Eve. We're on a night out. This is like 12 o'clock. So we're off our face. And like you have these conversations and a lot of the time they don't go anywhere. And there was something in my mind that just unconsciously clicked. And I was like, I want to do a gym session with this guy. So a couple of days after New Year's, I sent him a message because we added each other on Facebook. And I was like, hey bro, like, do you want to go and train together sometime? And he's like, oh yeah, awesome. I train. So I'm on the Gold Coast and he trains down in Tweed, which is about half an hour away. So he's like, oh, I train down here if you want to come and we'll do a session together. And I was like, awesome. Like, I'd love that. Went down, I did one session with this guy. And from that day forward to today where I sit, I've never touched a party drug since that day. I think that one moment of training with this guy who was, he still wasn't the role model that I guess I would like to have in my life now, but he was a step away from where I was. So we did this session together and yeah, from that day I was like, I don't want to go out partying and like that anymore and stuff. And this is what started me on this journey of fitness. So while this
what did
guy
he
was,
say
he
about
was
that?
Still,
cause he was buying the drugs off you. So like, obviously he was still into partying as well.
Yeah,
did you
exactly
stay
right.
friends with him?
So, yeah, like you said, like this guy was still into partying. Like we still went out and had drinks every now and then, but we weren't getting on the party drugs and stuff. But we were training 5 days a week. And that was what, as I said, got me one step away from where I was. So this is what I guess started me on this journey. And then it got to a point where I realized that even though like this guy got me into this sort of journey with fitness, he wasn't who I wanted to be surrounded with anymore. And then so one of the guys that I used to hang out with when I was in my like heavy party stage, we stopped talking when I started getting into fitness and stuff because I guess unconsciously it did intimidate him a little bit and we sort of just stopped talking, but then still followed each other, still connected. And then I saw via Instagram that he was doing ice baths and like breath work and stuff. And I just replied to one of his stories and I was like, wow, dude, like really good to see you're doing things to help yourself. Like I'm really proud of you. And then he actually said to me like, hey dude, like I'd love for you to come down and do like breathwork session with me. And I was like, oh, look, man, like I'm not into that. Like I'm not into the woo-woo sort of breathing on a beach stuff. I was like, dude, it's probably not my thing. Like, I appreciate the offer, but I'll pass. And he's like, oh bro, he's like, just come down for one session. He's like, if you come down for one session and it's not what you want to do, he's like, no hard feelings, like walk away from it. So he convinced me. I came down for one session. We did a 10-minute breath work on the beach. I opened my eyes and I was just like, holy shit. I was like, what the fuck was that? And just sat up on this beach and I was like, it was like a 10-minute breath work gave me a new perspective. And I was like, I don't know what we just did, but I was like, I want to do more of this. So this then completely switched where I was going in life. And I started to like invest myself in going to this breathwork practice every weekend. I got into a group called Brotherhood, which was like doing workouts down at the beach on like the bars and connecting. We'd do a breathwork after the workout. And I just absolutely loved that kind of work. And just, yeah, that was where I just dove into it.
What reasons did you find to love yourself?
I guess that would take me into like actually diving into the reasons why I had the thoughts that I did. So diving into all these reasons that these stories that I'd given myself, like the story that I wasn't good enough and the story that I wasn't the man that I should be. And it was all these unconscious patterns. So when I started to dive into it and figure out what they were, I started to create new patterns in my life and new beliefs unconsciously so that I could know that who I was enough and enough of a man to carry into this world the mission that I was put here to serve to other people and serve for myself.
And where did the self-respect start to come from and the self-esteem? So from the physical training, also for getting older and just having some more perspective and stop being so selfish and thinking about yourself all the time?
I guess one of the things that contributed massively to this was the first time I stepped into an ice bath. And this was a very humbling experience for myself. And technically, it wasn't even an ice bath. It was a natural waterfall in winter up in, so in the mountains in Gold Coast, it's called Springbrook. And I went on a retreat with this group called Brotherhood, where we were fasting for 24 hours. And this is something I'd never done before in my life. When I got told that we'd be not eating for 48 hours, I was like, is this like, are you nuts? Like, why would we not eat for 48 hours? Anyway, I went on this retreat and it was a very humbling experience because you hand your phone to them on the first day. You've got no food, no phone for 2 days. And I guess it gives you a massive perspective on who you really are because you've got to sit with yourself for 2 days. And on the second day, we went down to this waterfall, walking down, and they got us to walk down barefoot, which was also something that was out of my comfort zone. We got down to this waterfall and they were like, all right, boys, we're going to get in. And I was sort of like, get in the water. He's like, yep. So get your gear off. And like, it was freezing standing there looking at this water. I was frozen already. And I was like, no way we're getting into this water. So everyone started walking in, diving in and stuff. And like a lot of people there had done it before. So it wasn't too bad getting in, but I'm starting to walk in. It's getting deeper and deeper. And I'm like, how am I actually going to stay in here? My mate that was there even said like he had a tear come out as he was walking into the water. So experiencing similar to what I was doing myself. And anyway, we got in, did it. It was a group of brothers. We huddled around and did it together. And like that experience for myself was one of the most humbling experiences because for 2 days I got to sit with myself and I'd never done that before in my life. And this is something that a lot of men don't do in their life. Like when I speak about fasting or cold plunge, things like that, people are like, oh, as if you do that, dude. Like, why would you, even when it comes to cold showers, people are like, why would you have a cold shower? People are so resistant to this kind of work. And for myself, I was one of those people. So I guess I talk from experience.
Those things are hard and uncomfortable, but how does that relate to your self-respect and your self-love?
Yeah. So I think now from that experience, this is something I've implemented into my life is sitting with yourself, going on these retreats where you can do that and have these opportunities. And for myself, ice baths are something where for 3 to 5 minutes, it is you and nothing else in the world. It is your own thoughts and you get to sit with yourself and switch off. And it's something in that that doesn't get enough credibility because sitting with yourself has an effect that I can't say anything's ever come close to before that. And it's something that a lot of men don't implement enough in their life.
Well, something that a lot of people run from. And we've also got the perfect distraction in our hand 24/7 with the phone. So you can just be conscious of how often are you actually sitting down and not immediately looking around for a way to distract yourself, because when we do sit with ourselves for a minute, that's when some of those thoughts can come in, and a lot of us will be scared of that. We're trying to push that away. So we're like, oh, how can I get away from this? But like you said, whether it's from doing an ice bath, or maybe it's just you can do it when you go for a walk, or you can just sit down somewhere, or you can do some sort of activity where you're in flow state, but you're able to just like sit with yourself and think and not reach for that distraction. That's where you can actually learn about yourself. So what did 17-year-old Brad need to hear or need to have done that you didn't have and you didn't hear?
If I was to talk to 17-year-old Brad now, the one thing that I would tell him is accept help and stop believing that you can do everything by yourself.
That's it?
Yeah. I don't think there's much more he needed to hear, but it's so underrated. But just accepting help, because, and this is, I guess right now I'm talking to 17-year-old Brad, but if this resonates with you, then maybe I'm speaking to you right now, because it's something that a lot of people need to hear. It's not only 17-year-old Brad that needs to hear that. Accept help and stop believing that you can do everything in this world by yourself, because I understand as a man, a hyper-masculine man, you might have that belief like I'm the provider and the protector and I can do everything. But sometimes it's just about taking a step back from that, still protecting and providing, but also having the time for yourself, because you can't fill other people's cups from an empty cup.
Absolutely. So for you, it was actually allowing other men in to help you and having that connection and that brotherhood that's played a massive part in your own realization.
Yeah, definitely. And even now, that's what got me into the, I guess, personal development space, is working with men and realizing how important having a brotherhood is in your life. And even now, as deep as I am into this, I still, since my son was born, went through this chaos period where I wasn't giving myself enough time. Like, I'd tell myself, oh, but I go to the gym most days of the week and stuff, but I'd shut out the brotherhood. I'd shut out going to men's circles. And what I didn't realize is quite the effect that has on your life, and how important having a brotherhood of like-minded men around you is, that are there to look out for you and look out for your best interests.
And you've got to prioritize yourself and continue to prioritize yourself even when you become a parent and suddenly you're not necessarily the number one priority all the time. You have to keep doing all those things that have made you into a great man. You can't just say, oh, I don't have time for that now, because that's not going to cut it. You're not going to be able to be who you need to be if you don't do that work and allow that time for yourself. But it's pretty amazing for me, Brad, chatting to you now. I mean, 6 years ago, that's not a long time to go from being 17 to 23, turning 24 now, and now being a dad and being who you are. 6 years isn't a long time, man. So I guess finally, what's it like for you to reflect on that and to know that you could so easily not be here now and none of this would be happening?
Yeah, and on this subject, so often people go, oh, but wouldn't you love if you could go back in life and change X, Y, and Z that's happened? And I'm like, no, I don't want to change anything that's happened in life. There's things that I love that's happened in the past, and there's things that I don't love that's happened in the past, but every single thing has got me to where I am today. And if every single thing didn't happen, I wouldn't be where I am today. So why would I want to change anything that's happened in life? Because good or bad, it's led me to where I'm sitting right now, and I wouldn't change it for the world.
I understand that, of course, but you've gone through absolute hell when you've been incredibly lucky or blessed or whatever you want to call it to be here and not be paralyzed and still have this opportunity that you've got. And part of the reason that you're doing all this work with young people now is because you're trying to tell them that they can change that narrative and that perception and start taking off the mask and be who they want to be without going to that extreme and potentially ending or destroying their life. So I get what you're saying, whereas you wouldn't want to change it, but obviously you wouldn't wish that on anyone either.
Yeah, exactly right. And this is something, as you said at the start, a lot of people say to me, oh, you're so lucky to be where you are. And I don't like to believe that it's luck, because I create my own luck in life. So this is something that I want to be able to give to everyone, because everyone can decide at some point in their life to go from where we say you're at the cause of everything that happens to you're at the effect of everything that happens, and you can go to being the cause of everything that happens in your life. So going from being at the effect of everything to going to the cause is where you start to create your own luck. And this is one of the fundamental things that I like to teach, especially young men and young women in schools, is that you don't have to just go along with life and just accept everything that happens. Start implementing things and creating your own luck in life. Don't just wait for things to come. Go out and create it.
Yeah, take action and be the captain of your own destiny. I get you. Where can people go for more of you?
If you are on Instagram, follow me. I'm BradWright00. And if you would like a free video from me with the pillars of what I've used for my own mental health and what I still use today, just message me the word young blood, and I'm more than happy to send that over to you. Outlines everything that I've used in my life and that I still use today to maintain my mental health and my mental fitness. And I want to be able to give that to everyone.
Wicked, Brad. Thanks for going there, man, and reliving that and sharing the depth of that story. As we said, it wasn't very long ago. It's amazing that you're at where you're at now, but it's not easy to drudge that up and talk about it again in depth there. But I know that that story will resonate, particularly with people who are teenagers now, and just to see where things can end up if you give yourself the chance for it to go there, and that what you're so convinced of at the time when you're a teenager or someone of any age where you think this is it and there's no way things could possibly get better and no one's going to care, and you're so convinced of that, understanding that you're the one who's driving that and your thought patterns and the narrative that you're telling yourself, you're choosing that and you can choose to change that story.
Awesome. I really appreciate your time and energy of being here and giving me the opportunity to be able to dive into this, because yeah, as I said, like, it's really something I want to be able to help these, not only like young men and women, but I want to be able to help everyone in the world that I can possibly help not go down that path that I went down. And it's all about, I guess, as we said before, it's about first admitting to yourself before you even admit to someone else, and just letting go of that ego for 1 second and just reaching out, getting some help. Could even be going and buying a book around mental health or listening to a podcast. You don't even have to start by reaching out to someone else. Start with something small, and it's all about the baby steps. And then it's just gradually getting to where you want to be in life.
Great point, man. You're already doing it, Brad, so keep it up, bro.
Awesome, man. I really appreciate your time and energy today.
That's it for this episode. If you like what we're all about, support us by following Youngblood Men's Mental Health on Instagram and Youngblood Mental Health on TikTok. Every podcast episode is recorded in professional quality video, and they're all up on our Youngblood Men's Mental Health YouTube channel. So please show some love and subscribe. A big thanks to our local business supporters, Pro Realty Property Consultants and Herd Financial. You can find everything there is to know about the podcast at youngbloodmensmentalhealth.com. And most importantly, please share these stories with anyone in your life who needs to know they're not alone. We're all in this together. Catch you next time.